Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and fulfillment, this beautiful journey of life. Today, I will be speaking with Dr. Niaz Kasravi, a national expert and advocate on criminal justice, social justice, and racial justice. She's the founder and the director of the Avalon Institute for Applied Research Solutions. We will talk about the racial discrimination and the police department reform. Then I will speak to Diana Rowan, the author of The Bright Way. We will talk about 5 steps to create a brighter and a more creative life. Be sure to subscribe to my YouTube or Instagram or Twitter, Dr. Fujian Zain or Dr. Zain, and we'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
This has been an amazing week filled with different emotions: sadness, fear, anger, disgust, shame, guilt, love, connectivity, empathy, unity, with a sense of empowerment. I began exploring my own experience of prejudice and bigotry and ignorance. All the memories that I experienced being prejudiced upon, and all the prejudiced thoughts that I have had toward others, even if it showed up as stereotype humor, I took responsibility for my ignorance about not realizing how these individual biases can become systematic and cultural, which then were handed down to the next generation. I take full responsibility for minimizing the destructible impact of choosing to be or think and act from prejudice. My promise and commitment to myself and you are to be aware when such a thought show up and shift it to a loving and unifying intention. Listening to many of my clients, we also shared how, regardless of what race you are or what country you come from, people have experienced prejudice in one way or another, whether they were the victim of prejudice or the thinker or the actor of the prejudice. When you become a victim of prejudice, you may feel fear, shame, sadness, powerlessness, or hopelessness, or anger, or rage, and hatred. Your sense of self gets destroyed. You may isolate and limit yourself for the fear of being hurt over and over again, and you may even use your anger and rage to become a perpetrator yourself. When you are the person who acts from your prejudice, you may feel fear, anger, rage, disgust, and a sense of entitlement that you have the right to judge people from your categorization of what is good and what is bad. This would isolate and limit you anyway from the majority of people who are just not like you. The awareness of the consequences of prejudice, which is destruction, trauma, and isolation, might entice you to open your horizon and move forward to get to know every human being as who they are versus the category that you assign for them. The willingness to be curious and open to learning about people, cultures, and races that are different than yours will bring more sense of oneness, unity, safety, security, togetherness, and love into your own life. When you can unite with the similarities and cherish the differences in this beautiful tapestry of cultures on earth, you will feel a belonging to the human race and not just one race. So may you be free of the restriction of prejudice and free to connect and belong to all. Don't go anywhere. We got a great show for you. We'll be right back.
Take KMET 1490 AM with you everywhere you go by downloading our free smartphone apps found on the KMET website, KMET1490AM.com. You can also go to the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store on your phone to download the free app. Now you can listen live or play any of your favorite programmers' podcasts using your smartphone. Don't miss out on the free KMET smartphone apps. Go to KMET1490AM.com and download your free phone app today.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I am excited to be here with Dr. Niaz Kasravi. She's a national expert and advocate on criminal justice, social justice, and racial justice. She's the founder and the director of Avalon Institute for Applied Research Solutions, a research advocacy and training institute. Dr. Kasravi is the former director of the criminal justice program for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, the nation's oldest civil rights organization. It is a pleasure to have you here with me.
Thank you, Dr. Zaini. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a lot about what's going on right now. There's definitely has been almost 12 days of protests, and a lot has changed. A lot has been brought into, let's say, our awareness. Many people who maybe we were educated more about what's going on because finally, not only the African-American, the Black community is taking a stand, but everyone is taking a stand in order not to be put down, whether it's a prejudice or brutality or, you know, the unknown biases that we have or the denial for the biases that we have. And I see it as a very beautiful shift maybe in our society. What are your thoughts?
You're absolutely right. This is a very rare moment in history, even for those of us who've been working in this space. For myself, it's almost been two decades, just about 19 years. And I actually started working on policing issues, racial profiling, and police brutality. And even though we've seen some incremental changes throughout the years, it really hasn't changed the landscape of policing and the brutality and violence that is experienced by particularly Black communities, but other communities of color as well to different extents, right? And so a lot of folks for much longer than I have who've been working on these issues and have been trying to bring awareness and create change, are seeing this moment as something that's never happened before. You know, we saw similar uprisings, not to this extent after the Rodney King beating, but you have a lot of people who were not, who may be well-educated and well-intentioned people that for whatever reason just didn't believe that this problem existed to the extent that it does. And, you know, I was reading somewhere that it took a pandemic and all of us being quarantined at home and not having these other distractions and this gruesome video of this man being murdered basically by a police officer, for folks to really come to themselves and say, wow, you know, and to pay attention to what a lot of people have been saying. For sure, the Black community has been saying it throughout their existence in this country. So it's a rare moment where I think we can make changes that may have been impossible or much more difficult in the past. And just to be clear, I've been working on criminal justice issues and reforming criminal justice policies for about 19 years. And of all the issues I have worked on, from drug law reform to the death penalty to reentry for people who've been system involved, changing policing and policing culture is the most difficult of criminal justice reforms. And so I think we have to use this moment to really use people's attention and energy to make long-term change. And that change is not going to come merely by firing one officer, charging four officers, even putting several officers in prison for the violations that they have committed, the crimes they've committed. It's really going to require systemic change that's a long-term road. But we are seeing a lot of things happen in a very short period of time because people are paying attention, because people are on the streets and making demands, and because I think political leaders are finally realizing that they have to do something in response to the community's demands.
Why do you think, and what with your research and observation and experience, why do you think it is so hard to shift the culture within the policing environment? I know, for example, many of the fields, there are specific type of people to go to those fields. For example, you know, social workers, therapists, all of those have personal characters or have had traumas in the background, and they get gravitated to these fields because obviously not only they want to heal themselves, they also want to, you know, heal others. Maybe could it be also that a lot of people who go to become police, that they like power, they love the power that shows up. Maybe they were injusticed, you know, in their life, and they want to take that and be in a position to create justice for others. Or is it more of the like a leadership of the police departments that does not allow of the concept of, like, you know, the unity that they have to have, don't be a snitch, or those type of cultures that doesn't allow a shift within the culture?
Yeah. I think that you can probably find a range of different types of people and a variety of reasons that brought them to the policing profession, right? So, you know, often folks get caught up in this, you know, there's a lot of good police officers and there's just some bad apples, and that's not really the argument here. I think that, yes, of course, we need better standards and better training and better oversight and psychological evaluations and continuous oversight. And also, how does a police officer, what happens to a police officer once they violate their own policies and once they commit a crime? I think that's where we're getting caught up, is those policies around training and standards, we can beef those up, and we have been, right? I think the issue, the fundamental issue with policing has been a complete lack of accountability once a violation or crime is committed by a police officer. There's definitely a police culture that prevents other police officers to stand up against those that they work with who are committing these violations. There are strong protections by the laws and the police union contracts that protect officers who are accused of or do violate the law and the policy. And so they're quite protected from being truly accountable for their actions. So no matter how much training and how much better hiring policies and psychological evaluations you have and how many good cops there are in the field when you're not enforcing any system of accountability on a large scale to everybody, right? And like I said, a few examples will not change the system. This cycle will continue, right? And I think there's other issues that play into it. We're seeing in LA this campaign to defund the police, and it's been successful because during this entire movement after the murder of George Floyd, we saw the LA city budget and 54% of it had gone to the police force. And there are communities that that are in dire need of programs to support them and uplift them versus buying military gear for the police and equipping them with bigger and better weapons and making them really responsible to respond to every community need, right? So those are a lot of the systemic issues that have never been addressed. And then like every other institution in America, there is systemic racism that's been built into the system of policing, the criminal justice system. And so what that means is while the laws might be equal and fair on the books and say that they are to be applied equally to everybody, that's not how it plays out in the streets, right? So it becomes very difficult to reform that system with just taking care of a few bad apples and not addressing those deeper problems of structural racism and the protections that exist for police officers.
Let's open this a little bit more, because I know that with the slogans of dismantle and defund that's going on, it's also bringing a lot of fear for many people that, well, we do need our police. We needed, we've always needed our police in order to protect and serve us. And we do call upon the police when we need them for protection for many, many layers. And that the crime hasn't necessarily stopped just because, you know, people took a stand and said, you know, please stop the abuse of the police. But, you know, when you looked at the looting or robberies or many of the other things that are happening in the society, which people also need the support. So it's bringing some fear about what is happening because of the slogans are going on. And then there's this conversation of what happens, you know, it's just going to be an anarchy and nobody's going to have the police and we have to each now police each other and ourselves. And so let's open this conversation that even the conversation which you were saying, I just want to open it up a little bit, where when the conversation is about this defunding, it's more as I'm hearing as when the police was handling too many elements of maybe they weren't trained or it's under the police department and wasn't getting necessarily all the attention that it needed, maybe to take these programs and make them in different way. So for example, if there was a serve and protect, or if it was a crime, or if there was a particular way of handling a certain community, is that what I'm hearing, where defunding means refunding or shifting funds into different programs and allowing police to create a specific path that they can, which they can be doing, and other programs will be funded, the money will go into other programs under the police department or aside from the police department?
So I think it's important to not let hashtags and headlines induce fear, because we all want to be safe.
Yes.
All of our communities, regardless of our background, you know, our ethnic background, religious background, everybody wants public safety, right? So I think it's important that when people read things like defund the police or, abolish the police or dismantle the police department, as Minneapolis has taken the step to do, it's important to, rather than letting that give us a lot of fear, because and let our minds go to like the worst case scenario, really look at what folks are saying when they're saying that. So, you know, I think people that I work with don't mean let's just have anarchy tomorrow, let's fire all the police officers today and let everybody just fight for themselves, right? That is not the message. The message is we have poured a lot of money into policing and have tasked them with doing things that should not be in their job description, right? So what does it look like to have mental health professionals respond to people who are having mental health crises rather than calling the cops, right? What does it look like to have drug addiction specialists respond to people who are dealing with drug and addiction issues? These are all things we go to the police for. What does it look like for social workers to be responsible for dealing with folks who are homeless and the issues that they face on the streets where they live? Right?
Or domestic violence, which takes much more of a counselor position.
100%, right? The family disputes and the domestic violence. What does it look like to have a specialist that really knows how to de-escalate that situation and address that? Now, people will ask, well, what happens when things escalate and get violent? These are things we have to figure out together. So no one's saying, let's have anarchy. We're just saying what we've done has not worked. And public safety has to be created in a different way rather than just relying on police departments for doing that. Now, what the police look like, what their role is, what departments look like will drastically have to change, right, from what we know it today. But there are steps we need to be taking to get there. And I think that once we gain more knowledge about what communities and advocates are asking when they say things like defund the police or dismantle the police or abolish the police or even abolish prisons, right? I think people's minds just go to the fear of like, oh my gosh, it's going to be a free for all and it's going to be anarchy and I got to go arm myself to protect myself from all these people because the police won't do it. That's not the scenario that anyone is advocating for.
Thank you for clarification on that. Going back into racism, because these are two components that have shown up, although the protests are started with police brutality, but it turned into much more than that. It is looking at racism in the bigger picture, prejudice in a bigger picture. And although it starts with the African-American, and I think that everybody needs to look at that, but if we also extend it not only to the African-American or the Black, but look at all sorts of prejudice as it shows up in everywhere around the world, what are the ways of, let's say, educating people through however your thoughts are when, in Avalon Institute or different ways of how do you educate people about their own biases and prejudice? I think that a lot of times when these happen, they're a group that gets educated and drops those concepts, but there are also other groups which they get more righteous about where they are out of fear. Mm-hmm. And there are other groups that I've noticed where they look at one group, but they're not necessarily generalizing that to the other areas of themselves, which is still prejudiced upon another group. So they'll let go because they're getting educated about Blacks, or they get educated about LGBT community, or they get educated about something. But then they still don't generalize it into every other maybe cultural biases that they've had, which they've been raised in their culture with. Mm-hmm. In the 20 years that you've worked in these elements of working with the racism, what are the best ways or protocols that have actually worked where we can educate ourselves about racism?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, for different communities and different types of racism, whether it's overt racism, people who actually believe in white supremacy and white nationalism and or subconscious people who are more subconsciously biased. There's different, I think, ways to approach it, and there's probably different levels of success you can have. But I think all of it particularly for people who are well-meaning, requires really having uncomfortable conversations with yourself and with your family and with the community. And really being able to recognize your own biases. We talked the other day, you and I were speaking, and a lot of people have said this, that the woman who was taped in Central Park in New York several weeks ago, who called the police because a black man told her that she needed to put a leash on her dog, it came out later that she was actually a progressive. She had donated to these liberal democratic campaigns. And so these subconscious, you can draw a direct line from these subconscious biases that how dare a black man tell me to put a leash on my dog, to all the way to George Floyd being killed by a cop who felt like he had the right to do that, right? That he was able to do that. So I think it requires a lot of self-reflection and really calling out yourself and your family and your community for the different types of biases that we see. I think often we want simple solutions. So I went out, I protested, they arrested four cops. You know, we got some funds to the community. We redirected some funds from the community, from the police department. I can go home now, things are calm, and I can, you know, we fixed it. Or like, we elected the first black president, so racism doesn't exist anymore. And I think we have to really reckon with the fact that this is not going to be a simple solution and that we really need to dig deep. And oftentimes, especially as allies to the black community who've experienced the brunt of this, we have to listen to them and take their lead about what we need to be doing. You know, we can't swoop in as allies and want it to be about us, right? And want to be in the spotlight and want to be the savior. It doesn't work that way. We have to share the power and the leadership and really listen to their needs and then act, which I think a lot of us don't often do in our day-to-day lives.
In 1 minute, is there anything we haven't touched upon that you really, really want to share with our audience?
I think I would encourage folks to not just look at this as a moment and look at it as an opportunity to really change our country and our culture and our communities for the better, right? So, like I said, when the protests calm down, when we go back to work and the pandemic is over, this virus of racism and white supremacy is still going to be with us. We're just going to be too busy. And when I say we, I don't mean you and I just mean generally as a community, to really be engaged and involved and care as much as we do now. And I hope if there's one thing that this moment in history has taught us is that we have been wrong. You know, we have been, we haven't done right by the black community in this country and by communities of color. And therefore, we haven't done right by the principles for which we say this country stands. And I hope that this becomes a fight and really a part of our lives beyond this moment that we're in, because that's the only way it will truly change.
Absolutely. And as you were talking, I thought about it, that not everybody necessarily who has the unconscious biases related to white supremacy. Like they, you know, you have the concept of white supremacy as a certain group that I'm not part of, or maybe people are part of, but much more people around the world are not necessarily seeing themselves as part of that group, but yet they don't realize the subconscious biases that they do have although whether it's, you know, whether it's white to black or, you know, some class to another class or another countryman to another countryman. But there, it's knowing that type of biases that we have, sometimes very consciously picked them up from our cultures and kept going generation after generation, or very much subconscious ones to be really addressed. Thank you so much for the time that you gave us. I really learn a lot from you every time that we speak or I come to a place that you're giving lectures to. For everyone, please go and check out Avalon Institute, AVALAN Institute.com, to learn more about Dr. Niaz Kastravi. Thank you, Dr. Kastravi, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more.
Hello, listeners. This is Christopher from The Christopher Show. Hey, if you miss one of our shows here at KMET, don't worry about it. You can go to our webpage, and that's KMET1490AM.com. Go to the homepage, click on the SoundCloud tab, and hear any show anytime you want.
Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks? Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at Foujan.com, Foujan.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Foujan Zain, and I am excited to have Diane Rowan with me. She is the author of The Bright Way. She is a professional harpist and has performed on 6 continents. She founded the Bright Knowledge Guild to be able to teach in the digital environment, and she offers students around the world access to her system through an ongoing membership program, several dynamic Facebook communities, and videos. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you so much.
So tell me first a little bit about you. I love those harps. I see them back there, and I love harp. I've always loved them. I always think about when people choose to go and learn music, when would it be someone that would choose the harp versus violin or piano or guitar? And tell me about what inspired you first to be the musician and the harpist, and then we'll go to what inspired you to write this book.
Yeah. So originally I started on piano. My mom played the piano and still does. And so there was a piano in the house, you know, I had access to that and I would play around on it and really enjoy myself. And so then my parents realized, oh, you know, we'll give her some lessons and see how that goes. And it just went super well. I loved it so much, and wanted to be a professional musician really, really young. Probably by the age of 9, I already knew that I wanted to be a professional musician on the piano. But I suffered from terrible performance anxiety that really hit when I was about 10 years old, actually quite young. And that haunted me for a very, very long time. And actually the journey out of that performance anxiety is a lot what inspired me to write the book, because I realized, you know, the whole crisis of confidence essentially is a lack of connection to yourself and to your true purpose. So performance anxiety, though it looks like, oh, maybe it's just, you know, a little bit of a problem that can be categorized one way, it's actually to me a pretty major emotional, spiritual, physical problem, really. So as I worked through my performance anxiety, which actually caused me to give up music for 4 years solid, I went to a concert and I heard the harp. Mm-hmm. And when I heard the harp, it And so this would be in my early 20s when I heard that. It was this bridge instrument. It was kind of like a piano. You know, people call it a naked piano because you're directly on the strings. And it also has such ancient resonances. You know, we've all seen harps in ancient Egyptian iconography, for example. It's the most commonly depicted instrument in ancient Egyptian art. I mean, we're talking, you know, thousands of years old. And we find examples of harp in every single culture, practically. So there's something I think that all of us relate to the harp in a certain way, even if we haven't seen one in real life, because it's been in human consciousness from very, very early days. You know, it comes from the bow and arrow. And yeah, it became this bridge instrument. And not only that, you know, I grew up all over the world, and the cultures that perhaps influenced me the most were my teenage years in Cyprus, on the island of Cyprus, which is a very diverse crossroads of many, many different cultures. And while I lived in Cyprus, my parents lived in Iraq. And so I also got to know more about Middle Eastern culture in general. And I love the types of music, you know, Greek, Turkish, Arabic, Persian, oh, you know, Balkan. I love those types of music, but I couldn't really play them on the piano. They were sounding a little strange. But the harp, I was like, oh my goodness, this instrument can tolerate these sounds so beautifully and bring them out and really be a powerful, powerful bridge. And so that's what brought me to the harp.
To me, harp is just very angelic. I mean, the minute that I see it, I see like beautiful women like you playing it. To me, it's more like angels coming and, you know, bringing their beauty of the vibration to the world. That's just, it has that resonance for me. So I've always loved harp. So it's beautiful to know, you know, what got you there. Now, the next thing is you created Brightway System, and that's what your book is about. So what is Brightway System?
So the Brightway System is a very simple system for tapping into your creativity, your innate creativity. Everybody is creative. It is not reserved for a talented few. Everybody's creative. So it's a way of tapping into your creativity, number one, and then number two, following through on it. Because while we may get inspired by things that people do and say, then how do we actually take action on those things? How do we make them real in our lives? And so this system is a simple 5 steps that we follow, and it's actually a circle. So it's not linear. Once you've reached step 5, you actually prepare to re-encounter step 1. And a lot of that inspiration comes from nature, that nature works in cycles. It's a self-sustaining model. And therefore, our creativity is like that as well.
And you bring the elements of nature into the Brightway System. You bring the first one is the define your purpose, which is the fire. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah. So I'm always looking for commonalities, things that all people can agree on, that exist. And we can all agree that nature exists and the elements of fire, earth, air and water exist. And so they're a great starting point for us to work from. And when I think about fire, you know, that has a very inspiring nature. It has the drive to move us forward. It keeps us warm, alive, with a vision. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation that fire is, in fact, what brought human civilization into being, that when we were able to use the power of fire, we were able to cook things. And because we could cook things, you know, our brain developed in certain ways. We were able to stay warm and to huddle together in groups. We were able to tell stories around the campfire. So I'm using all the resonances of fire, the poetic resonances, but also the actual physical resonances. You know, what actually keeps you fired up and driving forward? And I believe it is your purpose.
When you talk about fire, is what type of, when you want to experience it inside of you, what do you sense when it's a fire? What kind of energy, what kind of creativity shows up with fire?
Fire feels to me like that spark that's inside you, that you feel this certain warmth, like, oh, of excitement. You know, sometimes it can even be butterflies, you know, so people are kind of like, ooh, that's a little edgy. That's, you know, but there's a sense of expansion inside of us. There's a sense of hope, of moving outwards in the world, I feel. But it comes from this sense of drive that's inside us, this kind of eternal flame. I mean, personally for me, what it feels like as well, this flame is my soul. There's something right at the core that is this really mysterious quality. And when we get in touch with it, it's like this endless fire, this sort of eternal flame that keeps us moving forward. Connecting that to purpose, you know, I've found that although people's purposes may change slightly over time in terms of wording, they never really change in their essential qualities. And that's what makes me feel like, you know, we're born with a purpose, and that when we come to know that purpose, it's a source of eternal flame, essentially.
And how do you tap into, based on your model, how do you tap into any of these type of energies? So for example, right now, if we're talking about fire, how do you tap into that? Do you tap into it by meditation or a particular exercise or music? How do you do that?
I think people will have their own particular ways of doing that. And so I think finding out, you know, what are you attracted to? What is it that you love? And following through on that thing, finding out what really fires you up and going with those clues that are given to you. Those are the ways to find your inspiration, and then also to honor your learning style. Everybody learns differently, and trying to force ourselves into a model that might have been, you know, given to us but doesn't really suit us makes us be in a situation where we don't really get in touch with that internal fire. So it's going to be both noticing what attracts us and following through on that, and the other inquiry is finding out, how do I actually learn? How do I, what is my learning style? This is a big, profound question. And I think we can all come to know what our learning style is. I firmly believe that each of us is our own best teacher. And by knowing our learning style, we become our best teacher. Yes, we can use outside guides and outside inspiration. I'm a huge fan of that. Ultimately, we are our own teacher. So those are the ways to tap into the fire, because when we know those things, we can follow through with great passion and drive.
So first, in your model and the book is define your purpose, which is connecting to the energy of fire inside of you. And the second one you say is set your intentions. And that you say it's the element of water. Which is pouring heart and soul into your purpose. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, so water is a very changeable element. It can be steam, it could be ice, it can be a little river, a massive ocean. And likewise, our intentions can be like that too. They can be very, very different. There is no one path of achievement. There is no one path of how things should be done. And in respecting, you know, this massive diversity of intentions, which are very much like water, then I think many options open up for us. Sometimes it seems that people's intentions, which are very similar to goals, but with some important differences, they get dictated by outside forces again. And rather than it coming from the inside out, very much like we just talked about with the fire being internal first and foremost, if we set intentions or goals that are really based on, again, some kind of external model or cookie cutter approach, it doesn't respect the element of water, which is this changeable nature and infinite variety. On top of that, water to me represents emotions. It has for, you know, many poetic resonances as well. Many philosophies connect water with emotion. And I believe that when we set intentions, when we set goals of a type, we want to have them actually come from a place of emotion first and foremost, rather than from a place of intellect. Intellect can come later, but we need that emotional connection first to our goals. And, you know, so when I think actually of even what's happening right now in the world, we want to respond from the heart, from the emotion first, have that heart connection. When we have that heart connection to our intentions, we have far more connection to them. You know, we care about them much more. Yes. And we're going to follow through on them much more than, well, I should do this. It's the right thing to do. It's right. On paper, this looks good.
Emotion really brings the action through the feeling. So when you have the feeling, it motivates you to go through, which is the next one, would be create your practicum plan. Exactly. Like, you know, that emotion that is behind it pulls you through in order to create that. And then you say that we got to tap into air, like prepare to fly.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that's when we bring in the intellect is, okay, now I've got the fire of my purpose. I know what's driving me forward. I've set some intentions that give me great emotional pleasure and joy. And now what I'm going to do is make them happen. So then we need a little clarity. So air is, you think about a breeze coming through. Actually, it's kind of windy in Berkeley today. And with the blowing away all the cobwebs, making everything really, really clear as to what am I going to do going forward. We're going to make decisions from this place of openness. So air is always associated with a very impartial look at things. You know, we're not getting bogged down by the past. We're not getting bogged down by rules. Everything is open and ready to have new action happen with them. So that's how we make our plans, is from this very open, growth-oriented state, very open-minded.
And then you talk about integration, which is connecting to the earth energy, grounding your intention in real life, like creating, manifesting it actually.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we've gotten all this fire and this water and this air. Okay, let's make this thing physical. Let's make it real. We want it not just to be a dream, not just to be words. We want it to actually be manifested, as you say, in this world. And so that's when we bring in the energy of Earth. What's it going to take to ground these intentions and make them actually show up as real things in this world? Not just hopes and dreams, but actual tangible things that we can physically see, put our hands on, taste, touch, whatever it is. It's going to be very, very earthy.
And then you talk about fulfillment, which is then the spirit and your ongoing creative story, where you could take what you've created and make it into a sustainable concept of that creativity as it relates to you. Can you share a bit about that?
Yeah. So in many world thought systems, there is a fifth element of spirit. So we had the earth, air, fire, and water. And then there's spirit. There is this ineffable life force quality that we can't put our finger on it, but we feel it. And so whether that comes from a spiritual place or that comes from a humanist place like ethics and community, essentially, this is a really important part of creativity. And in some ways, to me, it's the point of creativity. The point of creativity is to connect. It's to connect to yourself, your spirit, your soul, your true self, however you happen to see that. There is a core quality that is you and will never be replicated, no matter what your belief system. So again, I'm always looking for commonalities. What is something that's going to work for everybody, regardless of what political party you have, what background you have? I think we can all admit that we are a person, and there is an inherent dignity in that personhood that we want to respect. So with creativity, creativity connects you to that essential dignity that you have, and it affirms your place in the world. It says, yes, I have a right to exist and a right to express myself however I choose to do that. You know, maybe other people won't recognize that in a certain way. You know, they won't recognize my art form or the way I, cook, but I do. Sorry, I know you were going to say something.
Well, when you said that, it also resonated with what's going on now, the era that we are, that, you know, past 12 days of people also coming together and tapping into maybe all of what you just said, all of the elements, and showing the way that they need to take a stand or be supportive or empowered. You know, make policy. Some people do it through their fire of rage and anger and bring that emotion out, and others do it by, caring and loving and supporting. And, you know, there's all of that out there. So if you brought your model, The Bright Way, and attach it to what's going on, or see it, if we just see what's going on from your model, what would you share?
I love how you're saying that. You know, in nature, we need all the elements in order to exist. If we take away one of the elements, we take away fire, I mean, there's no world. We take away water, there's no world. Earth, same thing. All the elements are essential in order for life as we know it to function. We need all these different stories. We need all these different approaches. We want to respect this great diversity that we have on Earth, and nature again is our model. You know, she works in ecosystems of great diversity. When something gets taken out of the ecosystem, the whole system suffers. You know, when part of the ecosystem has been abused and neglected, the whole ecosystem suffers. It's nobody wins in this scenario. So I very much appreciate what you're saying about how all the elements are essential, that there is no one element that's better than the other. We need them all in order to thrive. And on top of that, that's why it's so important to get to know your purpose and to find out what resonates with you. How do you want to express? I know many people are wondering, you know, what can I do in these times? What would be the best course of action? And I think coming and checking in with yourself, knowing first, you know, what is my purpose? Then you will have far more success in choosing intentions moving forward that will be ones that are sustainable for you and life-giving and life-affirming, really.
Definitely. Thank you so much for being on the show. And I love this book. I think it's a great book. It's the same way she speaks, the same way the harp is so gentle. This book is a gentle way of you connecting with yourself and creating your intention and fulfillment. So everyone, go to DianeRowan.com. Diana. Rowan, Rowan.com, and get this book, The Bright Way. And it has amazing way of explaining and going through every element for you. Diane, in 1 minute, anything that we haven't talked about that you really want to share?
I love what we've talked about. And I think, you know, again, the main point of creativity is that everybody is creative. In fact, we must be creative because it reconnects us to ourselves and our inherent power and dignity. And it also thereby connects us to everybody else as well in a genuine way. And moving forward, I'm feeling like there's great hope that we will have more genuine connection than ever. And the myth of disconnection is going to fade away.
Beautiful. And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. Until next week, take good care of yourself. Bye-bye.